Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Professor Guy McPherson talks some more about global warming. The outlook is doom, but not gloom. But doom, definitely. Plus some words from George Carlin. I hope you'll stay tuned. Guy McPherson is Professor Emeritus at the University of Arizona, Professor of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. He has a disturbing message about global warming. It's out of control, and it's escalating faster than you imagine. Last week, we heard McPherson in a conversation with Michael Welch. We'll hear the second half of that conversation today. Last week, McPherson argued that global warming is here. To a large extent, it is man-made, caused by carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, which are caused in part by the burning of hydrocarbons, which is a key feature of Western industrial civilization. He argues that the atmosphere is not only warming, but warming faster and faster. The speed is increasing because of what is called self-reinforcing positive feedback loops. Here's an example. Increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps heat and so makes the Earth hotter. The heat is melting the permafrost over the land in the Arctic region. As the permafrost melts, large amounts of methane are released into the atmosphere. Methane is a greenhouse gas much worse than carbon dioxide. McPherson says 20 times worse in the long run and 100 times worse in the short run. So the atmosphere gets still warmer and gets still warmer more rapidly, which melts more permafrost sooner, which releases more methane. And this methane loop is only one of about 20 self-reinforcing feedback loops. There are 19 others. As McPherson calculates, the human habitat will be destroyed in about 40 years. The human species will be extinct by the year 2050. Scary words. And maybe the best we can hope for is that his calculations are a little off. Maybe we'll last until 2075, not just 2050. A decade here or there is not a pressing concern to me on the most personal level. In 2050, I would be 100 years old. Most men are dead before they reach 100. Contemplating one's own death is hard enough, but the death of the entire species takes some real effort to wrap your head around. But Western civilization is killing off 200 species a day, every day. And God has not been inclined to intervene so far. So I wouldn't count on divine intervention to save Homo sapiens either. I wouldn't count on human ingenuity to save the species either. Look at our record so far. Last week, I talked about how McPherson's words reminded me of Albert Camus' 1947 novel, The Plague. That novel explores the theme, how should you behave when you know you're doomed? I read the book back in 1969. Back then, it didn't seem like a question of any pressing importance. But in today's segment, Guy McPherson says that this is exactly the question we should be focusing on now. How should we individuals behave now that we're doomed? I don't want to give away too much, but I think the key term McPherson mentions is hospice. How should you behave when they put you in a hospice? That's how we should behave now. We'll follow this up with a brief sketch by George Carlin. First, though, here is Professor Guy McPherson.
So we have to change human behavior in addition to making this technological change or this techno fix. And can we change human behavior, civilized human behavior? I haven't seen much evidence of that. In addition, there's the there's a philosophical, maybe even existential question. Do we deserve that? Is there a better planet than this? Are we going to find a better planet than this? I mean, look at what we had here and that we destroyed and continue to destroy every day. We continue to foul the air and dirty the water and pollute every aspect of the planet while driving other species to extinction. And we're looking for a way out because we couldn't keep our affairs in order here? I'm not sure that's a reasonable expectation. After I speak, people come up to me very frequently and ask one of two questions. What about aliens? Don't you think there are aliens out there and they're going to save us? And my response always is, okay, pretend I'm an alien, and you tell me, you convince me that you're worth saving. And then there's the religious response. And there was this poor woman trapped beside me on an airplane a few months ago. And she was in the window seat, and I was in the aisle seat, poor woman. And she started promoting her religious beliefs. And so I started talking to her about near-term human extinction as a result of climate change. And she said, I just can't believe that God would allow that to happen to us. And I said, okay, so do you think he's pretty impressed with what we've done with the place so far? I mean, if really we are here to steward the earth, can you imagine a worse job? We were supposed to steward the planet and take care of things. Instead, we're driving 200 species a day to extinction and destroying all the habitat we need to survive. If I were in his shoes, I wouldn't be impressed.
God's saying, okay, let's scrap this project. Let's start over. But even I don't even think you have to be necessarily religious. It seems to me that there's that sort of psychology that might encompass certain atheists. They just can't believe that this is an insoluble prospect.
David Ehrenfeld, the conservation biologist, wrote a book many, many years ago, 40 probably at this point, called The Arrogance of Humanism. And that's where secular humanism goes, is that humans are actually special. That just like religious acolytes, they conclude that the planetary environment is here for us. I don't see a big difference between the secular approach and the religious approach from that perspective, in that maybe it's not all here for us. Maybe we're an evolutionary outcome based on a series of accidents that Stephen Jay Gould wrote in his book, A Wonderful Life. And we just happened to land here, and now we have all this power, and we really haven't figured out how to control it. And so we've launched this experiment. With respect to those self-reinforcing feedback loops, you know, we don't know they exist until after we've triggered them. So that's one of the great dangers here, and that is connected to human behavior. Okay. We recognize the emergency only when the building burned down. So that's a little late to send the firefighters in.
We have this extra little package in our cerebral cortex that allows us to defy nature ultimately to our own doom.
Yes, and so, you know, Homo sapiens, sapiens means wise, we're the wise apes. And I think that's something of a poor name. I think we're very clever. We're clever enough to modify the habitat around us, to come up with incredible technology, starting with clothing and fire, that allows us to persist in areas that other organisms wouldn't be able to make those adaptations. You know, so we're incredibly clever, but I'm not sure we're all that wise. We have populated the planet, every corner of the planet, and modified the planet so that we can occupy those areas. And it's all full now, and it's beyond full at this point. So now what becomes the relevant question?
I want to resurrect a question from last night, because I think it's a very compelling one, and that's the whole issue of the 1% or you know, the elites within the 1%, the 1% of the 1%, because it seems to me they would make it their business to know the truth, you know, whether it's pleasant or not. I mean, what they say to the public, that's a whole other issue. But what they discuss among themselves in terms of protecting their own legacies, their own lives, they must have confronted your diagnosis. How do you see them addressing this whole dilemma? How are they responding? Do you have any read on that?
A little bit. Of course, my take is quite limited because I'm not a member of the 1%.
You're not privy to those conversations.
And I'm not the fly on the wall.
Thanks for your report, Dr. McPherson. Go away.
But I suspect they are human beings, just like the rest of us. And so there's probably a continuum of responses that they've developed. They are the 1% in large part because they're psychopaths. So they do things that you and I would never do, if that includes backstabbing and hurting, maiming, killing people along their way to riches. That's okay, and they continue to get away with this because those of us who are not psychopaths would never think of that.
So they see this as an opportunity to make money.
Yes. Make more money as the world burns. It's always worked for them so far. In addition, I suspect some of them are counting on the techno-messiah to come save them, because she always has before. I suspect many of them are planning. In fact, I know many of them are planning for a future that includes them for as long as possible by moving to the Southern Hemisphere, where there will be habitat for humans longer than there will be in the Northern Hemisphere. So I think there's a wide range of responses, from we're going to keep doing what we've been doing so far that got us to this point, that got us our riches, until we can't. And again, we only see those self-reinforcing feedback loops in the rearview mirror. So they maybe didn't know what was coming until it was too late to do anything about it. And then it was too late to do anything about it, except buy property in South America and start developing that property so they can live out their days, or maybe the days of their children, in relative comfort.
Southern Hemisphere being a little bit more habitable in the near term.
Right, because it's so strongly dominated by water relative to land, for one thing. And also because the nuclear power plants
we haven't even gotten into the nuclear part yet.
Exactly.
Fukushima, yeah.
Right, so there are very, very few nuclear power plants in the Southern Hemisphere, and prevailing winds, general circulation dynamics of the globe will protect especially the southern portions of the Southern Hemisphere for far longer than places like the interior of a large continent in the Northern Hemisphere. You know, the interior portion of large continents, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, warms up more than twice as fast as the global average. So when we hit 2 degrees, we're probably looking at 5 for the interior of large continents. Where I live, the southwestern interior of large continent, Northern Hemisphere, that's the most rapid place to observe warming. So that's the place we're going to lose habitat for humans fastest. So I suspect a bunch of the members of the 1% are moving away from the interior of large continents, if they're young enough to make those changes and look forward to a few more years on the planet. Mm-hmm. Others aren't. Others are staying where they are. I suspect some are fully adopting the suggestions I make and living as if we're in hospice, living with compassion and with care for humans and other organisms in their final years. And, I mean, these are people who've had a good run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've had the comforts of civilized life. And so maybe some of those people are concluding that it has been a wonderful life, and they're going to go out with some dignity and grace.
Yeah. And take every other species on the planet with them.
That's one of the artifacts that we didn't know about for a long time, you know, that growing the industrial economy has consequences. And a lot of people still don't know that. Still aren't aware of that and are unconcerned when they find out.
Mm-hmm.
Because what has a little beetle done for me lately?
Of course, we are familiar with our political leaders' responses to these or non-responses to these facts. These leaders committed to the infinite growth paradigm are going to places like Copenhagen and these climate summits and talking about renewable energy and how we're going to cut the emissions by such and such by the year such and such. I mean, even with the Kyoto Protocol, even Rio, if I'm hearing you correctly, those proposals, those meetings were coming 20 years too late to do anything about the current situation.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And in addition, there's never been any implementation of the very modest agreements that were reached at those big meetings. So it was too late, it was too little, and as a consequence, we keep putting the pedal to the metal on a runaway train.
So what is the appropriate, for politically oriented citizens, we won't say politicians, but what is the responsible approach to once faced with confronting these facts? What is the responsible use of our remaining resources and time? What should we be doing?
Well, the very word resource raises my ire because it assumes that everything on this planet is for us, for humans. So when I hear the word resource, I think of the word relation. Now, I would like us to live in relationship to other organisms, not treat other organisms as resources. Mm-hmm. And it's gone so far, in fact, that we treat other human beings as resources. In my lifetime, we have gone from every corporation and every institution having personnel departments to having departments of human resources. We're all cogs in the wheel at this point for the corporations that rule the world, whether it's corporate government, corporate media, and now corporate universities. It's the corporations who are benefiting, and by the corporations who are benefiting, I mean the relatively few within the highest echelons of those corporations who are financially benefiting from the set of living arrangements. So what do we do? What do we do from a political perspective? I don't see any change. I don't see, even if the people rise up and try to conquer the corporate leaders in the society, I don't see the corporate leaders ever changing. And I don't actually see a lot of interest in having them do that. I don't know 20 people on the planet who think that terminating the set of living arrangements is a good idea. Never mind that it's taken us to the abyss, that it drives several hundred species to extinction. Never mind that it fouls the air and pollutes the water and all those other untoward elements that are consequences of industrial civilization. I still don't see very many people suggesting we stop. Hmm. We stop economic growth. No, that's anathema, and it's certainly political anathema. Nobody's going to be elected or reelected if they propose shutting down industrial civilization just because it's going to save a couple hundred species today and every day, just because it's going to allow us to clean our act. No, everybody I know is far more interested in smartphones than they are in clean water. Mm-hmm. So I don't see any big push coming along. As far as individuals, how do we take in and deal with this information and live with some element of grace and dignity and respect for ourselves? Well, that's personal.
I want to resurrect a line from your talk. You said, given the current situation, we're damned if we do, and we're damned if we don't. So do.
Yes.
You want to explain that imperative?
Yes. It seems to me that no matter what we do as individuals, we're headed for the abyss. But that's always been true. I've known since I was 11 years old I was going to die, that birth was lethal. Nobody gets out alive. I suspect most other people have reached the same conclusion at a similar age. That in fact, we're going to die. That no matter what we do, we're going to die. And that our years on this planet are relatively few regardless. Even if you live to be 80 or 100 years old, I suspect people who live to be 80 or 100 years old, when they look back in their final days, it's a few memories. It's the blink of an eye. So we have these relatively few moments that we remember. And we remember moments. We don't remember whole days, right? We don't remember whole hours in a row, even. We remember moments. So let's create those moments. If you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, then let's create moments by doing things that make the world a better place, so that we can look back at the end of our lives and we can retreat into ourselves and contemplate what we've done and leave the planet with a little shred of respect for ourselves. Because we acted with compassion and kindness towards humans and other animals, that we actually left more wood on the stack than when we came in, that we treated our planetary citizens, human and otherwise, with the kind of respect we hope people treat us.
Yeah, I think that like you're basically making that comparison between the life of a single individual and the life of a species. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people deal with the mortality question by saying that we'll live on through our offspring, through our works. And in this instance, there's no living on. I mean, we are really facing a mortality with a capital M.
Yes, and that's different. You know, we're
isn't it?
We're unique in that we have a concept of a legacy, right? As individuals, we can think about our legacy, but in fact, that legacy is lost to us as soon as we die. We don't know what happens. We don't know what legacy we have left behind when we exit the planetary stage. Now what I'm talking about is no legacy at all. No human legacy for any of us. So then what? That becomes the big question. That's the ecologically literate question, according to Gerhard Hardin from several decades ago. Then what? How do I live my life? And I would argue that we live our lives the same regardless, that we treat others with kindness and compassion, that we try to make the world a better place, even if the world is not going to be a better place, that we take the kinds of actions that we revere people for in retrospect, that we treat Rosa Parks as a hero for sitting where she did on the bus because she was, that we take those same kinds of actions, even at personal risk to ourselves, because they make the world a better place for humans and other organisms. Even if it's just for the day, even if it's just for the hour. Because remember, those moments are what we have. So let's live in them now. Let's live here now.
So that's where the optimism is. Knowing that our individual lives have that expiration date, it magnifies the significance of what happens in that short time frame. And now, as we're looking at the end of our species, everything that's happening from now until that final date, it magnifies the significance of us here and now as a people.
Yes. You want to exhibit some humanity? Some of the positive sides of humanity? What better time than now? For me and many other people, the message is incredibly liberating. I get to do the things that people thought were crazy. So far outside of the box that people wouldn't even consider doing them. Why? Because I'm mortal. I know I'm going to die. I don't care what culture thinks about what I'm doing. I don't have to care about that anymore because this culture is not going to be around for much longer. So I can take those risks that I've never taken before, and so can you. And those risks include kindness and compassion and wearing your heart on your sleeve and making the world better at great personal cost for humans and other animals. Yes, let's live here now as if here and now is what matters, because it is. In fact, it always has been.
Professor Guy McPherson, speaking to Michael Welch of station CKUW-FM in Winnipeg on February 7. Thanks again to Michael and to the Global Research News Hour for the audio, which I have condensed slightly. I've titled our show, Doom But Not Gloom. And Professor McPherson's tone is indeed not gloomy. Sort of wistful, actually. I found an old recording of George Carlin. I'm not sure exactly how old this thing is. Carlin is saying some of the same things as McPherson. If you gotta go, Why not go out with a little style? Carlin isn't wistful here, more like sardonic. Let's have a listen.
But you can entertain, and the only reason I suggest that you can have something to do with the way you die is a little known and less understood portion of death called the 2-minute warning. Obviously, many of you do not know about it, sure. But just as in football, 2 minutes before you die, there is an audible warning. 2 minutes, get your together. And the reason we don't know about it is because the only people who hear it die. And they don't have a chance to explain, you know. I don't think we'd listen anyway. But there is a 2-minute warning, and I say use those 2 minutes. Entertain, uplift, do something. Give a 2-minute speech. Everyone has a 2-minute speech in them. Something you know, something you love. Your vacation, man, 2 minutes. Really do it well. A lot of feeling, a lot of spirit, and build. Wax eloquent for the first time. Reach a peak. With about 5 seconds left, tell them, if this is not the truth, may God strike me dead. From then on, you command much more attention. Maybe you get your 2-minute warning and you're in the office. Get up and start your own funeral collection. What's the record, Bill? I'd like to top the record. Whatever your motive, you might be at an exercise program. Get up and volunteer for something strenuous. Do the Lindy Hops and refuse to stop when they do. Tell them you have a new exercise, the Hindu death exercise. Jump till you die. Maybe you get your 2-minute warning and you're in the audience at a faith healers program.
2 minutes.
Get up and get online with the Healies. Tell them you got the Willies. Nobody knows what the Willies look like anyway. Just get online and time it right 15 seconds. And you kneel down, she puts her hands on your shoulder, and you die! Got me. Evangelist slays worshiper. 50,000 look on. Police sift clues. That's what they do, man. Sift clues.
George Carlin, sort of echoing some points by Guy McPherson on New World Notes. If you missed part one of McPherson's talk, or just want to browse, check out our archive of past shows at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and Ask for the Plague by Albert Camus at America's Last Bastion of Socialism, your friendly neighborhood public library. That's spelled C-A-M-U-S. Camus. Send not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. And ciao.